Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. On this show, we're focused on breakthrough solutions, talking with people who are helping to create a more just and ecologically sound country and world that works for everyone. It can be frustrating to know we have solutions and yet watch our federal government fiddle in the face of so many problems. Our guest today draws our attention to a group of people dedicated to getting results with practical solutions every day. That is the mayors. Our guest is Dr. Benjamin Barber, a senior research scholar at the Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society of the Graduate Center at the City University of New York, also the president and founder of the Interdependence Movement, and the Walt Whitman Professor of Political Science Emeritus at Rutgers University. Dr. Barber brings a strong concern for democracy and citizenship to issues of politics, globalization, culture, and education in America and abroad. He consults regularly with political and civic leaders in the U.S. and around the world. His 17 books include Strong Democracy, the international bestseller Jihad vs. McWorld, and most recently, If Mayors Ruled the World. Dr. Benjamin Barber, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you. What a nice welcome. Is there any time for the interview after such a long introduction?
Yes, we have a whole hour. I love that. So tell us, why do you think mayors should rule the world?
Well, the old subtitle used to be Why Mayors Should Rule the World and How They Already Do, because in many ways, our cities, not just here in the United States, but around the world, are the only remaining effective and efficient democratic institutions that are actually solving real problems and addressing the needs of ordinary people. Our nation states, our international institutions like the United Nations and the World Bank are increasingly part of the problem, not part of the solution. We have watched in despair as our own government goes into gridlock, parties don't talk to each other, White House doesn't deal with the Congress, Congress invites foreign leaders to address it against the will of the White House, and these problems of ideological gridlock are not just in the United States. You'll find similar problems in France, in England, in India, and in many other places across the world. Nation states are increasingly dysfunctional. Cities, as they always have, continue to work because they have to. The example, Eleanor, I always think about is, you know, twice in the last 2 years, the U.S. government has closed its doors, literally closed its doors. Half the country didn't notice. But the reality is that cities never have closed their doors. Cities can't close. You know, U.S. government can close. Los Angeles can't close. Memphis, Tennessee can't close. Quebec can't close. Mexico City can't close. Cities provide all of those daily services and education, fire, security, jobs, hospitals that people need. Cities are the essence of government, and that's why I am talking about mayors not just running their cities, but coming together to rule the world.
That's a compelling argument. And you talk about the nation state as dysfunctional and failing us on a global scale, and that it can no longer provide us with a reliable foundation for human survival. What do you think happened with the nation state that put it in that kind of a position? Is it the ideological battles, or what's the problem there?
Well, there are a lot of contingent reasons that have to do with ideology, that have to do with the fact that we're still battling the 19th century issue of the market and capitalism versus social welfare state. But I think it's more, and you can't really blame politicians for this, it's more that the state, the nation state, has run its course historically. It was founded in the 15th and 16th century to encompass larger territories, whole peoples, the French people, the German people, the Italian people, the English people, and to give an effective governmental structure to areas much larger than cities but smaller than the Holy Roman Empire, out of which the modern era emerged. So for a long time, for 300 or 400 years, nation states really did deal effectively with most of the problems of their citizens inside their own territorial jurisdictions, whether it was transportation or the economy or health services or almost anything else. Even recently, they did it when I was growing up in New York in the 1940s. My mother used to say, don't go to Brooklyn. There's a virus over there. You might get sick from Manhattan. Well, you know, I don't worry about the Brooklyn virus today. I worry about the Mexican pig virus. I worry about West Nile virus. I worry about Ebola. I worry about HIV. I worry about the global pandemics that spread in a week or two around the globe. My first car in the 50s was a Chevrolet. Loved the American car. I have to confess, a BMW today, but you know why? It's built in South Carolina with 70% American parts, whereas the Chevrolets most people drive are built in Mexico with 60% foreign parts. So which is the American car? We live in an interdependent global world, and every challenge from warming and immigration and health and terrorism are cross-border interdependent problems. And the old independent sovereign territorial states that we've lived with for many years simply don't work very well in an interdependent world, because you have independent states with their own jurisdictions that don't know how to cooperate and can't cooperate to deal with what are really global problems. And of course, global warming is the first and most important exemplar of that. We've had 20 years now of nation states meeting and explaining why their sovereignty doesn't allow them to do anything as warming gets worse and worse, and extreme weather gets worse and worse, and we do nothing to curb carbon emissions because nation states can't function in an interdependent world. So it's the historical changes that make it so hard for nation states to function today, quite aside from the ideological issues we've already talked about. And cities, because they're at the local level, continue to work together. And it's my proposal that in order to deal with the interdependent problems that all cities share, cities need to work cross-border, interdependently, in global associations headed by a global parliament of mayors, in which cities do together what the UN has not allowed nations to do together, solve global problems that are also local problems.
Well, that's fascinating. So let's take your example here of global warming. I mean, you're certainly right. There's been a lot of international conferences, and you point out when you say international, you're assuming the unit of entity you're talking about is the nation state. But and I mean it specifically in this instance, nations have been getting together to discuss global warming for decades, and really not much has happened. So what are cities doing? Have cities taken action on global warming? Are they connecting with each other across the national boundaries to help each other deal with global warming in their territory?
Well, they have, Eleanor. It's very interesting. I mean, there's an institution called ICLEI, I-C-L-E-I, the Environmental Issues Organization of Cities. It's been around for 25 years, and cities have been meeting and doing research on climate change and on sustainability and so forth. More recently, Mayor Bloomberg and Ken Livingstone, the former mayor of London, worked to set up a C40 climate cities. 40 now today, 68 global cities that are cooperating around putting limits on carbon emissions and deadlines and targets to reduce emissions that have been far more successful realistic than the non-action of the nation states that have met in the so-called Committee of the Parties, the COP process, the UN initiated 22 years ago. We all remember Copenhagen 5 or 6 years ago, the big conference that tried to update the Kyoto Protocol, where after 2 weeks, 184 nations went home having done nothing. What people don't know is the mayor of Copenhagen invited 200 mayors to come, and they stayed. And through the C40 and through ICLEI and other organizations, they agreed on measures they could take. So cities are, in fact, already working together on common measures to increase the insulation standards, to reduce energy loss and wastage, to bring alternative energy sources into cities, to build turbines, wind turbines, even inside cities, not just in the rural hinterlands, but in cities like Hamburg, where if you go there, you'll see there are actually wind turbines inside the city limits, producing energy. Possibilities to buy alternative energy together collectively in ways that are cheaper and make it easier to buy alternative energy rather than petro-based energy. So yes, cities are already working together to make change. And if we were to have a global architecture headed by a global parliament of mayors in which all of the cities of the world could be represented and could come together and fashion common solutions, share best practices, explain what can be done, explain what port cities can do as against what inland cities to do, explain the relationship between drought in places like the southwest of the United States and sea rise and flooding in places like New Orleans and New York. You know, a lot of people think, oh, well, we don't see the connection. There's drought in the southeast and there's too much water in the northeast, and they say global warming, but look at the blizzards we've been having. Mm-hmm. But big blizzards are the result of a lot of moisture in the atmosphere because the atmosphere is warmer and it holds more moisture. So the storms, whether they're thunderstorms or tornadoes or winter blizzards, have a lot more activity, a lot more moisture because of global warming. And that's related to patterns that mean no rain at all in the southwest. So once we begin to understand the science of warming, then cities are in a position to act, and they are acting, and they need further institutional collaboration to act effectively.
Very interesting. Well, it's certainly true that mayors tend to be a lot more pragmatic and less ideological here in the United States than the members of Congress. And they do face daily issues and deal with them well, like, you know, the saying we heard and where I met you at the U.S. Conference of Mayors last week, you know, if you're picking up the trash isn't Democrat or Republican, liberal or conservative. You just, you know, get the job done and you plow the snow and you fix the potholes, and it's impressive what mayors do because they're dealing with very practical daily issues like I just mentioned, and they're dealing with a broad range of major issues. When you talked about the climate change, then there's weapons, there's trade, there's crime, there's drugs, there's transportation, there's public health. It's just kind of where the rubber hits the road on all the issues, isn't it?
Well, it really is. I mean, it wouldn't be great to ask John Boehner and President Obama, why don't you take responsibility for picking up the snow every time it snows across the United States?
And or even in Washington, D.C.
Or even in Washington, D.C. Because if you did, the one thing you couldn't do is close down government. The one thing you couldn't do is stand on principle and say, well, we're not acting until, you know, you do X, Y, and Z for us. Mayor de Blasio came to New York with a very exciting and important progressive agenda for reform that included preschool education and affordable housing. But before he turned around last winter, he faced six storms in a row. And for the first 3 months, all he could do is worry about how he's going to get the snow plowed, and he got in trouble because he didn't do it on the east side, he did it on the west side, and so forth. The same thing happened, by the way, to in 1960s and the 1980s, the mayors back then, mayors who came in with big agendas and found that if they didn't get the snow plowed, you know, they were in deep trouble. Well, you might say, well, that's just a petty small thing, but it's very important. It's what we have governments to do. I've never heard somebody in the Tea Party say in a city, oh, get rid of big government. We don't want those government snowplows out on the road. We don't want those government garbage trucks out on the road. We don't want our public schools open in the day. We don't want our public hospitals admitting, because that's big government. You know, it's not big government or small government. It's what democratic government is all about, providing the framework in which we can live healthy, educated lives, take our jobs, worship freely, have security in the streets. And we've seen their problems too. We've seen the police don't always protect citizens. Sometimes some groups of citizens feel they're being abused rather than protected. But what happens at the city level is that right away there are public demonstrations, right away there are inquiries, right away mayors have to take responsibility, whether they're Republican or Democrat, for what their police do or don't do to protect their citizens of color as well as the more privileged citizens. So cities are where the rubber hits the road, and it's very, very practical. You mentioned, you know, there's no Republican or Democratic way to pick up the garbage. There's a great story I tell in the book about Teddy Kollek, the long-term mayor of Jerusalem. And in the 1980s, as happens today, every day in his office he would find rabbis and imams and Christian prelates arguing with him about access to the holy sites, you know, arguing about the historical narratives that permitted the Jews or Muslims or Christians to have access to those sites. And he got so sick of it. He said one day, he said, "Gentlemen, spare me your sermons and I will fix your sewers." That's what mayors,
that's great.
And mayors, you know, that's what they do. They say, look, you know, stop yelling to me about big government or small government, about capitalism or socialism, and I'll plow your roads. I'll keep the schools open. I'll give you police who take care of everybody in town. And that's what democratic governance is about. And that's why I think most people around the world, whatever they think about the big ideological issues, when it comes to their own town government, when it comes to their own mayors, are very much supporters of democratic government. And by the way, that's why one of the worst figures in America we know, trust in the national government is very low. The president has, you know, 45%, 40%, even the Supreme Court that used to be very high is below 50%. And when you ask Americans what they think of the Congress they just elected, 92% say we don't trust our own Congress.
Holy cow.
92%. 9 out of 10 Americans. But, and that's true in many parts of the world where, you know, the trust levels in national governments are very low. But if you ask people anywhere, not just here, but in Europe or in India or Latin America, do you trust your mayors? Do you trust your city councilors? The figures rush up from 20 and 30% to 60, 70%. And 80%. We still trust local government, even when they're from the other party, because mayors are our neighbors taking a turn in government. City councilors are really about city districts, and they're our neighbors, and we know about them, and they're there to help make the city work. So we have a trust in democracy, which is heartening in a country where the trust in national government has eroded, and where young people and minorities and single women and many others simply say, this is not my government. This government doesn't work for me at the national level or even the state level. But at the local level, you don't have that cynicism, that distrust, that belief that democracy is for someone else. It's not for me. And that's a great thing for democracy and a great thing for our cities.
That's so true, and there's also the distance between most citizens and, you know, even people elected, you know, the state senate or the governor. Certainly their members of Congress are kind of off there in D.C. So, but with the mayors or the city councilors, people know them. They see them in the streets. I come from Boston, Massachusetts, and we had not one but two mayors, Mayor Menino and before him Mayor Ray Flynn, who, you know, you had something like 80% of the residents of the city of Boston said they had personally met the mayor, because the mayor was out there in the streets talking to people in the playgrounds, at the schools, at the different events. So there's a connection there between the citizen and the elected official that just no longer exists with so much with the state government or certainly with Congress. So I can see where people might have a greater level of trust and respect for the people that they're connected to.
Well, that's so true. Tom Menino, interesting. I met him towards the end of his life. He just died recently of cancer. He was there for 20 years, and as you say, he was very, very popular, beloved mayor. But when we talked to him about a year ago about the Global Parliament of Mayors, which was having a planning meeting in Amsterdam last September, he said, I want to come. I want to come. He had just left the mayor's office. I want to come. I want to be part of that. It is time for cities to play a bigger role in global governance. Let me come. And then he got so ill he couldn't come.
He made a
beautiful video. And we showed the video to the 30 cities that were represented in the planning meeting in Amsterdam, and people were so touched. And since then, Marty Walsh, the new mayor, has taken up the cudgels for the Global Parliament of Mayors. Says, yes, Boston wants to be part of that. So mayors are in a different place. You know, Ed Koch in New York used to walk around saying, how am I doing? Now, it's unthinkable that George Bush or Barack Obama would wander around Washington or anywhere else saying, how am I doing? First of all, they wouldn't want to hear the answer. The Secret Service wouldn't let them. And, of course, nobody would know, you know, sure, it's the President of the United States, but, you know, it's not my man. But a mayor can do that. He can say, how am I doing? Because he's a local. He's a neighbor. Cory Booker, who was the mayor of Newark until he made, I think, the mistake of thinking he'd have more power as a senator from New Jersey. In fact, he has less. But when he was the mayor of Newark, he several times on his way into work in his own car stopped. In one case, he interfered and prevented a mugging. And in another case, he went in. There was a smoky fire. He got out of his car. He went into the house and pulled out two people who had been overcome by smoke. Now, you know, again, that's because not that he's a hero, but he said, I just would do what any neighbor would do. It might be that George Bush or Barack Obama, they were both, you know, courageous individuals, would do that, but of course they would never have an opportunity. The Secret Service would never allow them. They wouldn't be driving somewhere where that could happen. There's a distance, as you say, between our national and state governors and legislators that just doesn't exist with mayors, not just mayors, but with city councilors and town managers and the zoning boards and the district councils that you find in every city, not just in America, but around the world. And I want to make clear to people that, you know, we were talking about American cities because we're here in America, but I travel all over the world, and I've been, my book, If Mayors Rule the World, is about mayors everywhere, not just mayors in the United States. And you will find the same attitudes, the same intimacy between citizens and their mayors, the same higher trust levels between citizens and city councilors and local governors that you do in the United States. This is genuinely a global phenomenon. Cities all over the world share the same problems, have the same density, produce the same creativity. I don't know if people know, but 2 years ago, the UN announced for the first time in human history, more than half of the world's population is living in cities. And in the United States and Western Europe and Latin America, that figure is closer to 80% of the people.
Wow.
And 82% of global GDP, gross domestic product, is produced in cities. Cities are wealth producers, they're culture producers, they're the essence of creativity, they're where 98% of the patents come from cities, and we know that problems come, global emissions also come, a lot of carbon emissions come from cities because they generate the energy as they generate the wealth and therefore have to deal with that, but cities are really the new democratic majority, the new wealth producers of the world, and what they lack is the political muscle that corresponds with their majority populations, with their capacity to produce wealth. And one reason in If Mayors Ruled the World, in the last chapter of that book, I call for a global parliament of mayors because it's time now for cities together to flex their muscles globally and say, we produce the wealth, we have the majority of the population of the earth, we create the culture, we do the inventions, we have the enterprise. It's time that we have a bigger role in determining the fate of a planet which nation states seem to have abandoned.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It's like awakening the sleeping giant with this global parliament of mayors. I want to talk some more about that in a minute, but first, you mentioned some of the mayors here, some of the great mayors of, you know, Mayor Koch in New York City, and we had Mayor Menino in Boston. You make a very astute observation in your book that there's almost a certain character type of a person who runs for mayor and is elected and reelected, and they tend to be very, you know, strong personalities. Can you talk a little bit about what makes for a successful mayor and some of the mayors that you think right now are in who are worth watching?
Well, two seemingly different, even opposite qualities are required. One is a very strong personality, a really strong personality. And that's because mayors, unlike the President of the United States or governors, they don't have a lot of power. They don't have a lot of executive authority. They can't snap their fingers and make things happen. Mayors, whether they're in a strong mayor system where they have a little more authority or whether they're in a weak mayor system where they have very little authority, Mayors have to work by persuading people, by bringing together coalitions of private and public, by getting businessmen on their side and getting unions on their side, by getting civil society organizations to pick up some of the burdens of government and take them on so that cities don't have to do it all, by persuading citizens of the taxes they pay, because big cities, you know, you pay not just property taxes, but in some cases income taxes as well, certainly sales taxes. People have to be persuaded that that money is being well spent. And the result is you need mayors with strong personalities, whether it's Ed Koch or Mayor Bloomberg, you know, very strong guy in his own right, or Tom Menino, or take Mayor Michael Nutter of Philadelphia. He's been there for a while. Terrific leader of the city. He said last year, which I love, he said, you know, we could never get away here in Philadelphia with the crap they do up in Washington, you know, fighting one another and closing down government. He said, I can't do that. You know, I've got to make this city work. Eric Garcetti is the new mayor of Los Angeles, and, you know, he's doing a terrific job at just even as he's learning what's going on. Mayor Reed of Atlantic, Mayor Rawlings Blake, the new mayor of Baltimore, Maryland. I mean, they just go on and on. You look at the mayor of Denver today, who is now become the governor of Colorado, Hickenlooper. The interesting thing about John Hickenlooper is that he was a nonpartisan mayor of Denver, but when he became the Democratic governor of Colorado, he ran into a lot of trouble because suddenly he had to be partisan. Suddenly he had to be a strong Democrat, not just a Republican. So the further up they go, the harder it is. Kevin Johnson, who was a three-time All-Star basketball player, is today the mayor of Sacramento, California, and also the president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. Mm-hmm. You know, amazing guy. Joe Riley, an amazing South Carolinian who's been in office for 40 years, the longest-serving mayor. Talk about Tom Menino, twice Tom Menino's length.
Wow.
He's an ex-president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. He's still deeply active, and he's helping us right now think about the development of a global parliament of mayors as well. So again and again and again, you get these extraordinarily strong personalities. But right next to that, and here's that other characteristic, you have to be pragmatic. So mayors are pragmatists. They've got to solve problems. They've got to make things happen. They can't rely on grandstanding. You know, they can't say, well, I'm not going to do that because the other side won't agree with me. They might start out a businessman like Bloomberg, but they still have to deal with the unions. They might start out a progressive union guy like de Blasio in New York today. You still have to deal with the real estate lobby. You still have to deal with Wall Street. If you're the mayor, you got to deal with everybody, and that means you better be a pragmatist. You better say what works, not what works for my ideology, what works for my city, what works for Sacramento, what works for Seattle, what works for Louisville. That's what you need to say when you're mayor. And you put those two qualities together, strong force of personality, but a very pragmatic approach to problem solving, and you get a level of efficiency and governance capacity that just doesn't seem to exist at the state or the national level. And I'll say something interesting about those qualities, because I learned something when I wrote If Mayors Rule the World that I didn't know. You'd think all the amazing mayors we've had, and we've just named some, but you can go back in time and think of the great mayors of Chicago or New York or Los Angeles or Atlanta, going all the way back in time, or Miami. In our history, there has never been a mayor of a major American city elected president of the United States.
No, is that so?
Senators, representatives, businessmen, college presidents.
Governors.
Governors, of course. Never one mayor has become president of the United States.
Fascinating.
Calvin Coolidge was mayor for a few months of a small town in Massachusetts. And Cleveland spent about a year as the mayor of Buffalo. But otherwise, no mayor of all those who you would have thought would go and tell me, you know, Bloomberg was interested.
Giuliani still may be.
Was interested. Still may be, but my point is it doesn't happen, and there's a kind of disconnect, and it may be too bad for the country, but that's why I'm saying let's not make mayors presidents. Let's let mayors, while they're mayors, come together and together make the common decisions that govern the planet, because they know how to do it. But because they're pragmatists, because they're not party creatures, they don't work hard for this party or that party, it's much harder for them to assume national offices. So let's take advantage of who they are, what they do, and put them together in a global parliament that allows them to become global governors and do the hard work that our national presidents and prime ministers can no longer do.
That's really fascinating. And what do mayors do now? I mean, I know you're talking about the global parliament of mayors, but how do mayors learn from each other now? What are their best sources of learning about the best practices happening in other cities around the country and around the world?
Well, that's a great question, Eleanor. And the easy answer is a lot more than you think. Mm-hmm. Here's a quiz for your listeners. You know, what is the UN? I'm going to give you some acronyms. Everybody's going to say, oh, that's easy, right? What is the IMF? Most people will say, oh, yeah, that's the International Monetary Fund. What's the G8? Well, that's the big, you know, countries, the European countries and Japan who kind of have the big economies and so forth. Now I'm going to throw a ringer at you. What is the UCLG?
UCLG.
What's the U? Now, I suspect out there in radio land, there's a whole lot of silences and head scratching. And, you know, ask your teenage kids, ask your student who's studying political science in college what that is, or even ask the professors who teach political science.
I would guess
how many
the,
can
like,
answer.
The Union of Cities. I give up. What is it?
Well, United Cities and Local Governments.
Oh, United Cities and Local Government. And I follow politics and government closely, and I didn't know that.
It's 100 years old.
Really?
It came after World War I from two 19th century organizations of cities. And while it's a rather dull bureaucratic organization, for 100 years they've been doing research on cities. They've been holding meetings. The mayors usually don't come. Half the mayors in it, by the way, when I say, so what do you know? What do you go to the UCLG? They say, what's that? Mayors themselves don't know. But the point is, it is an association of cities that is doing research and working to try to solve city problems. There are other more active ones. I've mentioned them, like C40, like ICLE, like the U.S. Conference of Mayors. But there's not just the U.S. Conference of Mayors. There's a Mexican Conference of Mayors and a Japanese Conference of Mayors and a Canadian Association of Municipalities and so forth. I mean, every country has its own, and they cross borders. Moreover, you've talked about sharing best practices. Barcelona, there are certain cities that are city leaders. They're involved in all kinds of organizations. Stuttgart in Germany is one. Barcelona in Spain is another. Barcelona has been deeply involved in urban leadership around the globe. And last year, they teamed up with Cisco Systems and created something called City Protocol. And it's an online organization in which cities and policymakers in cities everywhere can go online and share best practices, ask questions of one another, say, here's how they're dealing with this question, or saying, we have a question, how are you dealing with it? And it has become the first global web-based protocol that allows cities to share their problems, to share their solutions, and to talk to one another about it. It's a kind of virtual foundation for the global parliament of mayors that I call for if mayors rule the world, because it already allows a lot of sharing. And when we talk about a global parliament of mayors, we are also looking for a virtual platform that will allow mayors to meet not just by traveling to London or Tunis or Dubai, but sit in their own city hall offices and meet with other mayors around the world in a virtual platform, in a kind of civic Facebook, in a global Google Hangout, where mayors can really work together and talk together on a regular basis without having to leave home, because it's hard for mayors to justify spending too much time away from their cities. So these virtual platforms that are developing are equally important to sharing best practices, to cooperation and knowledge sharing among mayors, and we hope we can use those platforms and maybe get Cisco or Google or IBM to work with us to develop a platform so that the Global Parliament of Mayors can meet not just once a year or once every other year with hundreds of mayors coming together, but can meet every 3 months with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of mayors sitting in their offices, but talking to one another, joining in work committees, joining in task force of the kind that the U.S. Conference of Mayors already have to solve problems together. The new technology binds cities together worldwide in a way that makes it possible for city cooperation to happen without mayors ever leaving home.
That's fantastic, and it's very encouraging to hear about all the different organizations that are out there helping mayors connect with each other and learn from each other. And if we already have those organizations, why do we need a new entity, this global parliament of mayors you're advocating?
Well, here's the problem. We have all kinds of wonderful associations and affiliations and conferences that bring cities together, that shares practices, but not one of them is a true governing organization that exercises power so that problems can be solved collectively. And what we are calling for with a global parliament of mayors is a kind of governance keystone in the arch of all the different institutions that are out there. In a way, we need something to hold up and give strength and vitality to global urban cooperation. We need an actual governance organization. We need the equivalent in cities of what the United Nations is for nations, except because nations are sovereign and squabbling and rival, and because the Security Council offers the five leading nations a veto, the nations of the United Nations do very little together that makes a difference for the world. The special, the Secretary's office does a lot, and that's great, but the United Nations is really the disunited nations. But what we need is united cities. We need Tom Cochran, the CEO of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, said to me, it's time for the U.S. Conference of Mayors to become a World Conference of Mayors. And I said, yes, but it's time to make the World Conference of Mayors a governing association, not just a best practices association, something that uses collective power. Let me give you a couple examples, Eleanor, if I can, of that, because
sure, go ahead.
I know that's well, what do you mean, you know, power? What do you mean governance? What's different than just sharing best practices? Well, let me give you an example that came from Stephen Fulop, who's the new mayor, ex-Marine of Jersey City, which, by the way, people don't know. What's the largest city in New Jersey, I say to people? They say, well, Newark, New Jersey. Last month, Jersey City surpassed Newark and is now the largest city in New Jersey. Stephen Fulop is the mayor. He's concerned, as so many city mayors are, about guns. We know the minute you try to do gun control, the NRA is there. The rural population is there saying, no, you can't have any curbs on guns. So he had an idea that if cities worked together, here's what could happen. It turns out that American municipal police forces buy up to 20% of the guns and ammo sold in the United States. If they together, in a governance organization of mayors, said, we will pool our resources and we will buy guns and ammo for police forces all over the country, or if it was in the global parliament of mayors, all over the world, we will only buy from companies that don't sell armor-piercing bullets. We will only buy from companies that don't sell big magazine rifles. We will only sell to companies that don't sell fully automatic weapons, to military-style weapons, assault weapons, to the public, because the only role such weapons have is to kill cops and commit crimes and create mayhem. We will not do that. You don't have to deal with the NRA. You don't need legislation. You simply use the market. I guarantee you that if you went to companies and said that, there would be no company that wouldn't immediately say, okay, we'll stop, you know, doing mm-hmm. that small percentage of our business if, in return, we're guaranteed that you're going to buy guns and ammo from us. By the way, the U.S. government buys another 30 to 40% of guns and ammo. If they joined in, you could, through the market force of collective political buying power, pooled buying power, make this difference. Same thing with energy. If cities agreed to pool their resources and buy alternative energy, that would make it much easier for expensive alternative energy companies to lower their prices because they would get the pooled market force. So there are examples of what cities working together can do that they can't do alone. By the way, the city of Washington, you know, tried last year to say we are going to ban handguns, and the U.S. court sued them and said you can't do it. It's against the Second Amendment. And they had to abandon that. And so today in Washington, the gang kids who are killing each other with guns continue to be constitutionally authorized. But if cities all over the country band together and brought a case that would go to the Supreme Court eventually saying we have the right together to ban handguns that is in the that are bad for the public interest of our cities, or to ban certain kind of handguns, or at least to register handguns, that's something that cities could do together with their pooled power that they can't do one by one. And now spread that worldwide, and you have the possibility of cities together representing more than half the world's population, 80% of its wealth, 95% of its inventions. You have a capacity collectively to reach conclusions and policies that, when pursued together, solve problems. 80% of carbon emissions come from cities. If cities together say, we will deal with those carbon emissions, it doesn't matter whether nation states do anything. 80% of carbon emissions can be eliminated. And that more or less solves the problem. So cities, when they pool their power, when they make collective decisions together, when they go to the market as one single buying force, are in a position to affect real political changes in the world that improve the sustainability of the city and the health and the welfare of citizens, not just in cities, but citizens everywhere.
Well, that's a really powerful strategy you're talking about. You know, cities joining together with their joint purchasing power can really reshape the market. That's fantastic. And you wrote in your book that we could get cities raising emission standards for vehicles within their city limits, and that if enough of them did it, they could force the car industry to make much more energy efficient vehicles. So that, you know, there again, you talk about the 80% carbon emissions
exactly
coming from the cities. We could stop it that way.
Sure. And by the way, California's already done it. The cities of California and eventually the state of California decided to raise emission standards higher than the national standards were and said, you know, we're only buying automobiles that have those higher standards. Well, Detroit and indeed overseas, they had two choices. California buys up to 20% of the cars sold in the United States. So
wow.
the car companies can say, well, let's make 20% of our cars with higher emission standards, and the other 80% we'll make with lower. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. If you're going to raise your standards on engines, raise them on all of them. And that's exactly what happened. The fact is that America's automobile industry now exceeds the emission standards of Washington because it is obeying the emission standards of the state of California and California's cities. So again, when cities work together, and maybe even get state government to work with them, then you can have this extraordinary effect that doesn't require you go to Washington and defeat the NRA or defeat the Petro, the oil lobby, or the carbon lobby in Washington, which we know how hard to do that is. Cities can do it directly through collaborating with one another because they are the majority. They produce a lot of the wealth. They are where it's at and have a capacity already if they work together. And this is no different than what happened, you know, in the 18th century, we had a weak confederacy of colonies that kind of worked together after the War of Independence, you know, in 1776 for 12 years or so, and everyone agreed that the Confederation just didn't work because they hadn't really pooled their power. They hadn't created common power. And the government of the United States of America that came out of the Constitutional Convention, and in 1789 started a new federal government with a central bank and central powers, showed that when the colonies, when the states really worked together and created a common governing organization, they could control the destiny and the fate and solve the problems of their people. It's time for cities to follow that example. Working alone, working separately, working in loose associations of cooperative allies, that's great, that's useful, but in the end, it doesn't utilize and concentrate the power and decision-making and capacity of cities when they work together to solve real problems. And a global parliament of mayors will do that.
Yeah, it's a fantastic idea. And you spoke last week at the U.S. Conference of Mayors here in Washington, D.C., and you made an impassioned case for this global parliament of mayors. How receptive are the mayors to your call for a global parliament of mayors? Are they backing it? Are they skeptical? Or what's
well,
the
let
response?
Me say it's. It, let me say. Let me start by saying it was an idea. It's now a reality.
Okay.
Not just mayors here, but mayors around the world have said, "Let's do it." And I'm happy to say, and you can get information on my global parliament of mayors .org website about this. There will be the first sitting of a global parliament of mayors of over 120 cities coming together in London next October, October 23rd and 24th in London and in Bristol, England. First sitting in London, second sitting in Bristol, 2 hours away. Didn't forget, two cities involved in it. We'll have 120 mayors. It is happening, and we have taken it to mayors around the world. We have already the mayors of Bogota, Mexico City, Rio, Los Angeles, Seattle, Sacramento, Boston, Calgary, Barcelona, Rome, Athens, Warsaw, Helsinki, Singapore, Seoul, Yokohama, the list goes on, Cape Town, Dakar in Africa, who have said, we are in, we want to do this, we will be there. Moreover, you mentioned my appearance last week at the U.S. Conference of Mayors. Tom Cochran, the longtime visionary CEO of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, Kevin Johnson, the current president, mayor of Sacramento, who I mentioned, both said, we want to partner with you in this effort. We want to be a partner in the convening of this global parliament. So we have the active and welcome partnership of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and we're looking to do the same with the Mexican Conference of Mayors and the Japanese Conference of Mayors and many others. So this is a reality, not an ideal or a dream. It will happen next October, and we also have the collaboration of, I mentioned, the C40 climate cities. They're working with us. We have the Nobel Laureates Climate Symposium meeting in Hong Kong. They've invited me and several mayors to come to Hong Kong to talk about cities and climate change and to come full circle. We will make as our first policy issue in that October meeting of the Parliament of Mayors, the issue of what cities can do together to have an impact on carbon emissions and climate change, whether or not nation states do anything. We hope, obviously, that the nation states meeting again next year for the 22nd time in Paris now to see if they can make progress on the Kyoto Protocol and a global protocol. And we hope that what cities do in October in London will help change the attitude of the governors. But whether or not the nation states do anything, we will hopefully in October have a manifesto, a climate manifesto for cities that will allow the world's cities, with or without the help of nation states, to take major actions to curb emissions, to check wasted, to involve alternative energy, to stop leakage through bad insulation, to involve alternative sources of energy, to pool buying power, and to allow cities to make genuine progress on the most threatening issue we face, the issue of extreme weather, climate change, and creating a sustainable world.
That's awesome. I love your vision, and I love that you're creating really another source of power that can challenge the corporate dominance that seems to be, you know, running our country and sounds like many other countries around the world, too. So, you know, hats off to you for taking something from an idea to operational, and it sounds like your vision is becoming more real by the day. I do want to ask you that, you know, there is the problem with the nation states about the influence of big business, and as the cities grow and recognize their power coming together, wouldn't those same companies try to influence the cities as they have the nation states?
Great question, and yes, of course, I'm not naive. Of course they will, of course they do. But I want to say two things. One is something more general about capitalism and about corporations, and the other is about the relationship between private and public in cities, which I think is very different than the relationship between private and public in states. Let me start about corporations. I am a great fan of the capitalist market when it comes to producing wealth. There's no question there's never been a system that was more innovative, more inventive, more able to produce wealth. But we also know that capitalism is a dreadful system for distributing wealth. It's not a very good system for creating jobs because it's finding ways to create wealth without creating jobs. And it's certainly not a very good way to pursue issues of justice and equality. That is the role of the democratic state. And capitalism works best in tandem with an overseeing democratic state that takes up issues of jobs and employment and justice and fairness and equality and makes rules and regulations that force capitalism to work within the confines, still produce wealth, still do what they do so well, but not do it at the expense of the public sector, and not do it by ignoring what are called the externalities of capitalism. You know, capitalism pretends that, you know, it just makes all this wealth and money, but of course it does it with consequences that the public have to pay for and that it doesn't pay for. They're called externalities. When a plant makes a chemical and dumps half of the residue in the river and it pollutes the river, capitalist company says, it's not my job, perhaps the paper company on a river says, it's not my job to clean up the river. That's the public's job, but that's an externality, but it's not really external. Capitalism has created that. So capitalism needs democracy. But that means I don't blame capitalists for making all the money they can. I don't blame capitalists for, you know, trying to improve the welfare and health of their shareholders and their stakeholders and so on. That's their job. It's the job of democracy to contain and govern and oversee that in a way that is good for the public realm. And my problem is not that capitalism continues to push hard, but that we have stopped supporting democracy as the container, the box inside of which capitalism has to be placed. And that's the fault, that's our fault as citizens. And what I love about cities is that cities are saying, we understand that. We understand that we have to provide the infrastructure. We have to pay for the externalities. We have to make sure that capitalism works in a way that is just, that creates jobs, that leaves people with equality and with pensions and with minimal pay. Notice that cities are raising the minimum wage way above where the nation is because they understand, mayors understand, they have to have a living for their cities. So cities, in fact, are in a position to do this. But here's the number two thing. Because cities are local, because corporate CEOs and managers live in cities for the most part, I have noticed that inside of cities, it's not so hard to create public-private partnerships. It's not so hard to create. If you wanted corporations to pay for the space program or the military, they don't want to do it. But if a corporation in a city, you say, we want you to help clean up the harbor front and create a better place for living and education, but also for business, businesses are likely to do it because for the same reasons that citizens see the scale of local government as impacting them, businesses understand that the quality of education, the availability of jobs, the nature of architecture, the creative culture that is in a city are all part of what allows corporations to do well. So my experience has been that public-private partnerships work much better in cities. There's much less of that deep cleavage between left and right in cities. And that's why, in fact, a lot of mayors don't even identify as Democrats or Republicans or pro-union or pro-business, because you got to do both inside the city. So this is not to say that issues of inequality, issues of corporate influence and money don't remain a very tough issue for every level of government, including cities. It is to say that I think we have a better chance both to get the goodwill of those who run corporations and banks and so on inside of cities, and that we also have the power and the capacity of cities to create the boxes, the containers, that make capitalism safe for public interest. And that's what democracy has to do. And the better democracy works, the better off capitalism is. Democracy works better in cities than anywhere else, and that's a good thing for those of us who want to control the influence of corporate wealth.
Right. And I think, you know, we all support having the public-private partnerships on behalf of communities. And there's some great things that I've seen, we've all seen happen in cities. But I will say I just had a shiver up my spine when I saw the presence of Wells Fargo at the U.S. Conference of Mayors last week. And I know they've got a new grant program from Wells Fargo to award $3 million to support local nonprofits to promote long-term economic prosperity in the communities. And I think that's good. But at the same time, we know Wells Fargo is probably the top of the list, or certainly one of the worst banks in terms of their kind of ripping off consumers with excessive fees and fines and some of the shenanigans that went around with the mortgages.
You sure got that right. And you know, the problem is when we don't want to pay taxes, when we starve cities and states and even the national government of the resources to do what they have to do, they're thrown back on having to beg corporations, beg banks to help out. And of course, the banks and the corporations exact their price in influence and in policies that serve corporate and private interests rather than public interest. So, you know, one easy way to break the stranglehold that corporations have, whether it's on an organization like the U.S. Conference of Mayors or on cities or states, is to be willing to pay what it costs to make democracy work and not make democracy a beggar. When democracy is a beggar, it falls at the feet of those who have money and ends up with a Supreme Court that says corporations are people and speech is money and money is speech, so it's all okay, and we see what the results of that are. Those are very real problems we have to deal with. And that kind of hypocrisy you do find. The other thing, I don't know if you noticed, the U.S. Conference of Mayors, the U.S. Beverage Association was a major sponsor, and they were sponsoring an anti-obesity campaign.
Right.
Now, I love that. That's great. We should, you know, we all know our kids are too fat and so on. Why are our kids too fat? Primarily because the American Beverage Association puts sugary beverages in every school and all over the country, and kids, you know, drink all this crappy, sugary soda
and
food. So here, you know, this is, we call it greenwashing with the corporate world. Here, the Beverage Association is kind of trying to convince mayors that they're the good guys, whereas if they really wanted to be the good guys, they would take all their soda machines out of schools and insist on natural fruit juices and water as the primary liquid for kids. But, of course, that would cost their stakeholders a lot of money. So, yeah, there's a lot of hypocrisy. And to the extent organizations, whether it's the U.S. Conference of Mayors or anyone else doesn't have the funds to do the good work it needs to do, it's got to make compromises and figure out how to get some support from those who do. And I guess the good news is that at least when they get the Beverage Association of America in there, they get the Beverage Association of America in there not to sell more soft drinks, but at least in theory to be opposing obesity and looking for healthy diet, of which those beverages are not a part. So.
Exactly. Well, I'm so happy to hear you're going into this with your eyes wide open about that. And we have just about 30 seconds left, but what can our listeners do who care about what you're talking about, and how can our listeners learn more about your work?
Three things. One, support your local city government. Get involved in participatory budgeting. Join a city council or zoning council. Make sure you are an active, engaged citizen in your town, because it will count there. It will make a difference. People always say vote nationally. Sure, do that, but engage as a full-time citizen. First of all, that's number one. Number two, inform yourself more about the Global Parliament of Mayors, globalparliamentofmayors.org. You'll find a lot of information on what you're doing. You can get on a mailing list, and we'll keep up with you. And third, because I need to eat too, and because you need to know more about it, please buy the book.
Which I highly recommend.
Get it on Amazon. It's If Mayors Rule the World, Dysfunctional Nations, Rising Cities. Yale University Press published it, but it's not just a textbook. It's a book for everyone. It's in 12 languages around the world right now, and you'll help me and yourself, because you'll get the answer to every question you have right now in that book.
That's all the time we have. Benjamin Barber, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thanks a lot.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Many thanks to our research associate, Dr. Judith Singleton. I'll be back 1 week from today with my guest, Harold Morrison, to discuss middle-class economics. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor Lacaine with All Together Now. Now that we know.